Hello and welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I'm your host, Nick Agar Johnson, and we have a new guest in the building for today's episode. I'm here with Jam Hines to talk about his most recent article. Jam, how are you doing this fine evening?
Doing great. Excited to talk about the article and some of the guys mentioned in it. It's going to be a good session. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So why don't we get started with just sort of the most basic level. So this is your first piece in your series called A Scout's Eyes, which you're going to be running throughout the season. So I just wanted to start off with that at the most sort of basic level. What made you decide to go with this series, and what made you decide to start off with Robert Hinton for writing about the series?
For sure. So I just really wanted to do something that gives a perspective from scouts and just kind of, at least from my eyes and scouts in general, because I'll be adding some stuff from what I'm hearing as well. But just really talking about just the evaluation process on certain guys, wanting to highlight a lot of the underrated or under the radar type of guys as well, giving them their due credit and attention throughout the season. And we'll be touching on the bigger prospects as well too. But that was just kind of what I really want to focus on. We'll eventually get into some draft philosophy type of things as well. And wanted to talk about Robert Hinton. He was a guy that I was curious about coming into the year, having seen a little bit of his high school tape at Harvard Westlake and also Team Why Not as well. And just obviously when you have a top 100 guy deciding to go to Harvard, you know, that's always fascinating, you know, and just thinking about what his decision-making process was to get there. So I was the guy that I was tracking from the beginning of the preseason and getting into the year. And then when I have a chance to come see for him to see him live as well, I thought it was the perfect time and the way that he was playing to start the year. It was just a nice little alignment of the stars and the universe for me as well. So it was great to be able to talk about with my first piece here.
Certainly interesting. I mean, first of all, Harvard Westlake is a school that I always think of as baseball school, just because, you know, Jack Flaherty, who just started game one of the World Series, went to Harvard Westlake, Lucas Giolito, a whole bunch
Freed,
of
yes.
Max Fried, exactly. A whole lot of baseball talent, but not really particularly a basketball school. And, you know, there is sort of the easy low hanging fruit joke to make about going from Harvard Westlake to Harvard University. But,
no doubt.
You know, it's an interesting sort of program situation with Harvard. I mean, Tommy Amaker has been there forever, and there've been a lot of guys who, you know, it's one thing to say there aren't many top 100 guys that go to Harvard, but it's been very interesting. Certainly the last, you know, 5-10 years, there've been a lot of, you know, maybe not top of the line guys, but I mean, Mieoni out of Yale got drafted a few years ago. I think he was 57th overall, if I remember correctly. There's a lot of sort of late second round talent that ends up at Ivy League schools. And it's, you know, sort of fascinating to see where things go from there. You know, certainly another Yale star, Danny Wolf, just transferred to Michigan. Seems like that's certainly going to help out his stock. But even still, there's a lot of talent that's sort of maybe not in that top 100 high school prospect range, but ends up being certainly in consideration for top 100 lists. I mean, you talk right up front about Javian Lee out of Princeton, who's been on second round boards at No Ceilings since probably middle of last season, somewhere around then.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, there's a lot of talent in the Ivy League that's maybe, again, you know, not maybe top 100 is rare, but there's a lot of sort of conversation about guys who might be second round flyers in a way that, you know, 10 years ago, watching Brandon Ingram destroy Yale in the first round of the NCAA tournament, it's a bit of a different feel than sort of what we're getting out of the Ivy League these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's just the influx of talent that we're getting in the Ivy League. And we'll talk about Malik Mack towards the end. But unfortunately,
absolutely.
I guess fortunately for him, but unfortunately for Harvard and the Ivy League, him transferring out. But you just have so much talent that hopefully not too much of it gets poached out of there. I mean, it's a great setup for the Ivy League for what they can offer student athletes off the floor as well. So I'm excited about just the future of Ivy League hoops and what they've done so far.
So let's dive in a bit deeper into Hinton. And it's one of those things where, you know, this is the part of the season where basically every scout, every analyst has to say small sample size like 74 times before we give any numbers. But in the small sample size of three games so far, in average 24 points, six rebounds, just under two assists, while shooting, you know, again, small sample size, right? But shooting 50% from deep, shooting 60% from 2-point range, just incredibly efficient, incredibly high level scoring in a way that you don't expect out of freshmen in any conference, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And for him to, as I mentioned in the piece, for him to come out doing and excelling in the parts of his game that work for him on the high school and grassroots level, that's exactly what you want to see. Kind of the worst thing is when a freshman comes in and it's just like, uh-oh, none of the stuff that was working for me on the high school level, that's not working for me at the collegiate level right now. And granted, of course, we'll see how the rest of the season plays out, get into some stiffer competition. You get deeper into the Ivy League where teams have had a chance to scout you more, play you multiple times. But so far, so good from what we're seeing.
And, you know, the interesting thing, too, is because of sort of where the Ivy League is at, you know, conference power ranking wise, it's not like you'll see with, you know, some of these big schools that take on like the Montana College of Mining and Nursing, right? Like they're taking on opponents that are at their level, if not higher, you know, when you're talking about Marist, Navy, American, you know, teams that, again, are in that sort of mid-major mix. It's not like you're having Duke beat up on a D3 team, right? This is about even level of competition that he's excelling against.
Yeah, for sure. So it was good to get that and then to go out on the road early as well, and also neutral site. So for him to be able to have those type of competition and also those environments is certainly a plus early in the season.
So why don't we get into sort of breaking down the reason why Hinton's been so successful to start the season. And the place to start, as you mentioned in the piece, is how good he is at getting to the basket and finishing through contact, but also drawing that contact. And that's, you know, I think a pretty critical distinction, especially when you're talking about freshmen. You know, anytime there's a jump up in competition level, you're going to deal with a jump in, you know, a whole variety of ways. But I think particularly foul drawing is an interesting one to look at, because all of a sudden, you know, especially for someone like Hinton, who's, you know, coming from, again, Harvard Westlake, not a traditional basketball powerhouse, right? There's the question of, okay, how do you scale up to the dramatically increased physicality from the high school competition that he was getting? And, you know, he got better competition on the AAU circuit, sure. But generally speaking, you know, that's an area where a lot of younger players struggle just because they haven't put on the weight yet necessary, or, you know, they are struggling to adjust to how much smaller the windows are in terms of getting into the lane, in terms of getting past a big man to finish. So for a freshman to be this good as, you know, a finisher around the basket, but also getting to the free throw line at this higher rate, it bodes very well to sort of, and we'll get into this later in the piece, but the difference in sort of what you might expect from him at the NBA level versus what you might expect from him at the college level, having that foul drawing as an ancillary skill is going to be very important for his transition to the next level.
Yeah, no doubt. So far through the three games, small sample size alert again, but he's
there. We go.
he's up to 7.7 free throw attempts per game. When he gets downhill, he's attacking relentlessly. He's seeking contact. And I've just been so impressed with his ability to use both hands at the rim as well. He's not deterred about any type of contact that's there. It won't prevent him from going back and being just as aggressive at the next time. And for him to be able to absorb that type of contact to finish, and at 6'5", 190 pounds, still growing into his body, fairly thin frame as well. That's just the type of stuff that you love to see. As I mentioned in the piece, you know, that wiry strength that you see from guys with his build. And I just love the mindset when he's there that he's not going to be stopped. He's going to try to find a way, whether it's getting to the line, trying to find a finishing angle, drawing the contact, or whatever the case is going to be. He's able to get to the rim. Mostly from what I've seen early in the season, it's been through transition. A lot of the stuff, it's getting him downhill sometimes on stampede catches. It's him navigating off-ball screens and curling and getting to the pull-up as well, too. And, you know, he is the cousin of Rip Hamilton, one of my favorite NBA players, especially being in the DC area, his time here.
Yeah, that's a strong start right there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, and I'm a sucker for NBA bloodlines. I just think being able to have that access to that type of resource from what they can learn and off the court, on the court, just the tips and kind of tricks of the trade to give you just a little bit of a head start getting into the league. But you see a little bit of that screen navigation. I wouldn't quite call it Rip Hamilton-esque just yet, but I have loved his ability to be able to navigate screens and get downhill in the finish. One particular game, from a particular possession at the American game, he felt like he was going backdoor. Then he spins, comes around, curls around, gets the ball, quick spin back to the left side, loses the defender, and finishes with the left hand. So I just love being able to see him work off the ball in addition to what a lot of usage and what he's doing on the ball as well.
So I want to go back to the transition game stuff in a minute, but I do want to stick with this bloodlines point that you made, because I think it's a very important one to make for a variety of different reasons. And I'll get to my most frequent crutch that I lean on this podcast, because your first appearance, you haven't heard me shoehorn in a Kings reference every 5 minutes. We're 11 minutes in and I haven't yet. That's pretty impressive for me. But you know, the reference that I shoehorn in less, but I think is relevant to the discussion we just had, is, you know, I have a background as a psychology neuroscience major in college. And one of the things that I think is it's really the part that's impossible for scouts to evaluate. So maybe a scout's eyes isn't the series to bring up this point, but you know, the idea with the bloodlines that you bring up, it's not just, okay, you know, there are only so many people in the world that are, you know, 6'6" and up, right? There's only so small of a pool that you're drawing from for basketball, but you know, just the psychological element of how much easier it is if you've seen the pathway in front of you. If there's someone, you know, you're close to, whether it be, you know, a mentor, you know, a coach growing up who played D1 ball, you know, shows you sort of the pathway. There's really an element to which, you know, especially when you're talking about someone who's going to have a lot of shooting gravity as part of their NBA profile, that confidence is a part of it. And part of that confidence is, you know, okay, anybody who makes it to the NBA is going to be psychopathically competitive and confident just because you have to be to make it that far. But, you know, there's an element to which it's a lot easier to sort of have that confidence if you can go to your cousin who's literally Rip Hamilton and say, hey, can you help me figure this out?
What a luxury that is, you know, from anything, whether if it's just like, all right, how do I prepare on, you know, back to backs, or what's life like on the road? What type of routine I should be doing? What should I be eating? You know, just what should I be expecting from coaches? How can I lean on different aspects and different resources that are available to me in the NBA facility? So just having that, like, it's certainly incredible. And I think it's a real advantage.
So now we go back to the transition point where I can shoehorn in my Kings comparison. And it's always very interesting to me when I see a young player who at least part of the game is going to be having the ball in their hands, right? This isn't as true necessarily for like a 7-foot rim runner defense type. But, you know, just the idea of having watched De'Aaron Fox's development for the Sacramento Kings, and he comes into the league, he's the fastest player in the league immediately. But he's 6'3", he's 175 pounds listed, which I think they forgot to put the decimal point between the 7 and the 5 on his listed weight. But, you know, he came into the league, he was incredibly left-hand dominant, and, you know, he had the speed, but he was, you know, in a way, it's funny because you think of, you know, sort of some prospects have elite physical tools and some prospects don't, right? But, you know, you mentioned the wiry strength, right? Like, it took De'Aaron Fox 3 years before his ankles were literally big enough that he wasn't just going to get pushed off his spot every time. And to have sort of the things, like, De'Aaron Fox had a lot of runway to figure those things out because, you know, with his athletic tools, you're going to have a lot of time to, you know, figure out sort of the more skill base is not even the right way of putting it, but, you know, have that sort of developmental window. If you're already at the point, you know, as a freshman where you can finish with both hands, where you do have that sort of wiry strength, where you can get yourself to the free throw line, you know, Robert Hinton has a lot less wiggle room than De'Aaron Fox does because, you know, there's a pretty wide gulf in athletic tools, which is going to be true between De'Aaron Fox and pretty much everybody. But the fact that you have some of those sort of more nuanced, more refined parts of your game as a freshman, it makes it very easy to sort of imagine the transition to the next level, especially when you think about the fact that, you know, he's going to be playing more of a support role at the next level as opposed to scoring 25. If Robert Hinton scores 25 points a game in an NBA season, I will be very happy for him. I will also be very, very surprised.
Yes, yes, for sure. Like, when you bring that up, and it's a couple of things that really popped my mind as you said that. For me, one of the concerns that I do have about Hinton is the physical tools. Yes, he is 6'5", and there's good length. We'll see what happens wingspan-wise when he gets measured and we get those type of measurements at the end of the year. But he's not the most explosive athlete. He's not really going to wow you with the vertical pop, the lateral quickness. So I'm really looking for what does he do to compensate for those things. And then really one of the things that he does is, we'll talk more about it a little later too, but just the footwork that he has to be able to create separation, the understanding of how to use screens, when he gets to the rim, finding those finishing windows with both hands, being able to absorb contact. So all those type of things can help him compensate to an extent. That extent is remains to be seen, of course, but it'll kind of determine really what it looks like for his advantage creation on the NBA level.
I think the footwork is the key point to mention because, you know, that's really an area where you can make up for a lot of other deficiencies. And, you know, it's, again, you know, going into my Kings bag very quickly, but, you know, with DeMar DeRozan, someone who's been, you know, one of the most spectacular athletes in the NBA for a long time, but, you know, he's not someone who, you know, unlike his sort of Raptors predecessor, Vince Carter, it's not like it has to be, well, I mean, Vince Carter ended up being one of the greatest three-point shooters of all time, and I will never slam Vince Carter on this podcast. But the idea that I was trying to get there before I had to defend Vince Carter's legacy from literally myself was the idea that DeMar gets a lot of those points by being such a technician in the mid-range, and it's why, you know, at 25 years old, he was averaging 20 points a game. And at 35 years old, he's averaging 20 points a game, right? It's one thing to have a lot of leeway when you're DeMar DeRozan. You have a lot of athletic leeway to not necessarily need that footwork. But if you're not a DeMar DeRozan, right? Like, you know, if you're trying to think of another good example, if you're, say, this doesn't quite work because he's a bigger guy, but if you're, say, Kyle Anderson, right? You're not going to blow by anybody at the next level, you know? Because, again, he's slightly larger, maybe he can, you know, post someone up, you know, drive them into the hole. Okay, fine. But that's not the majority of his game, right? The majority of it is, can I get to my spot quick enough that you can't guard me? And you don't need to be, and, you know, again, it's one of these funny things where it's like, you know, Brian Scalabrine would destroy any single one of these people athletically, like into his 50s, right? Like the gap between athleticism of, I remember one time I played an intramural game in college, and for some extremely unfair reason, there was somebody on the other team in this, again, intramural game who ended up walking on to the school team. And it was just hilarious to watch. He was 6'4", and literally all he did was just walk into 25-foot pull-ups. It was like, I don't care about, like, I know I'm faster than you, I know I'm stronger than you, but I don't care about any of that. I just want to settle for 30 jumpers a game and embarrass you because there's absolutely nothing you can do, right? And those are walk-ons for D1 programs. These aren't guys who are being considered NBA players. So, you know, there's a little bit of a sort of, you know, set the baseline of, you know, what is athleticism, right? And, you know, the idea, that's a ridiculous concept for me to say as a question, but, you know, the idea here being, okay, you know, if you're in the 99.2nd percentile athletically for someone who's 6'5", you're a below average NBA athlete, right? It doesn't mean you're not a ridiculous athlete, but we're talking about, you know, the idea, and this is a phrase that I've said on this podcast 7,000 times by now, but, you know, if something in the college game is a matter of feet, in the NBA, it's a matter of inches. And so being that precise with your footwork allows you to create looks offensively and cut off angles defensively that, as you said, can compensate for, you know, okay, maybe he doesn't have the greatest burst. Maybe he's not the quickest laterally, but if he knows where he's supposed to be and he knows how to get there, you can make up for a lot of those deficiencies. And if those aren't deficiencies, you end up being DeMar DeRozan. But if they are deficiencies, you know, you can still be a very impactful, you know, more Kyle Anderson-esque kind of player.
Oh, for sure. And that's in line with what I'm really still trying to figure out about Hinton. It's a small sample size. Here we go again. But it's, is he settling for jumpers? Is it because of the just the great confidence in his pull-up game? He gets tremendous elevation on it. He can shoot over a lot of guys and have shot over a lot of guys. But at 6'5", when you're probably going to be guarded on NBA level by taller wings, 6'6", 6'7", longer wings, what does that look like? Do those become more contested shots? Are they not as clean looks for you? What are you doing to kind of continue to compensate for those? So I'm really looking forward to see the kind of the tricks and things he utilized, especially with the footwork, which is the skill that I'm really, really excited about for him to continue to leverage, because for him to be able to understand how to utilize it in different situations to create space and for him to get to something for himself or for others, which will be the next step for him as well. It's just incredible to see as a freshman within his first three games. So that's only going to get better. So strength for him now, but when he becomes a sophomore, junior, however long he plans to be at Harvard, he's going to continue to get better with that.
So I want to drill in on the shot making for a moment, because this is one where you, I think, look at it with, you know, this is too easy, low hanging fruit, but I'm taking it anyway. You have to look at it for a different set of eyes when you're evaluating how does this guy look on a college floor versus how do you project him to look on an NBA floor. And that's where the tough shot making comes into play, which is there aren't that many players on an NBA team that are sort of authorized to take those looks, as it were. Like, you know, okay, everybody gets a shot clock grenade once in a while, and, you know, you have to try and figure out what to do with it. But for me, that's where I often struggle with a lot of these prospects who are tough shot makers in college, where, you know, first of all, if you're doing it on Hinton's efficiency through his first three games, it doesn't make any difference, right? If you're 58% from the floor, 50% from three, it doesn't, you know, like, you can take those tough shots and make those tough shots all day long, right? That's totally fine. But that's where things sort of start to get tricky for me in terms of translation, because on the one hand, yes, it's very good in terms of projection for his skill set purely as a basketball player that he can take and make those tough shots. But how much latitude will he have to do that at the next level? And, you know, if he ends up playing professionally in Europe or Australia or any one of the many, many, you know, high level professional leagues that aren't the NBA, maybe he does get to take and make all those sorts of tough shots. You know, like I say this all the time with Jimmer Fredette, of if Jimmer Fredette was willing to be a slightly lesser version of, you know, somewhere in the JJ Redick, Grayson Allen sort of mix, he could have had that career. He did not want that career. He wanted to score 30 points a game in China, and now he's scoring 30 points a game in China. And so, you know, that's sort of where the distinction comes for me of, okay, it's great that he can take and make these tough shots, but if we're trying to think about Robert Hinton, NBA player, not Robert Hinton, college prospect playing for Harvard, what kind of impact do you think that shot making has and would potentially have?
I think it'll have a big impact playing off of spot ups and those type of things, where he still can get to his pull up game, being able to attack, close out, still get to the rim, get to the pull up, be able to hit those type of tough shots. Granted, I think you'll have to have the coach and the system that will encourage a little bit more of the pull up twos, you know. No. That's kind of a forsaken thing in the NBA to get those pull-up twos, unless you're someone like DeMar DeRozan, KD, of course, like that, and be able to operate like that. But I think it'll certainly be operating off of spot-ups, being able to eventually play against the bent defenses where some of the athleticism and handling ball-handling questions aren't that big of a deal at that point, because you're attacking a moving defense that's already shifting, which will be able to help him out a ton. But I really do believe that the experience at Harvard is going to be beneficial for him, because although he won't play as much as that NBA style role for him, which that 3-and-D off a spot up, just kind of hit your open shots and work that way, he will get a chance to play with the ball a lot in his hands, go as a pick and roll type of player. And one thing I'm huge on is role versatility. So for him to be able to show that he can do both of those at the NBA level and then kind of creep into some on-ball reps, you know, with the second unit, where the situation going to be, I really do love that for him. And then just one of the things that I've been taught, and I'm sure that you've been taught and you've been heard, and but I really try to really hammer home and try to make my evaluations as simple as possible. The majority of guys that are coming to the league in the draft class, they're coming to support a team. They're not coming to be that number one, that number two option. So what are you doing in that supporting role? So those are the type of skills and things that I'm looking for. And I do think that is there with Hinton. So he has that with him to continue to develop. And he also has that added aspect of being able to play with the ball in his hands as well to develop that role versatility.
So I do want to move over to talk about the defense in a minute, but I want to stick with the offensive side of things for just another moment. First of all, I think that's an excellent point that you make, you know, especially with someone who the idea is a 3-and-D wing. You know, this was mainly more for defensive concerns, but someone that always sticks with me is Troy Daniels, because man, could he shoot the ball. Just one of the best shooters in the league from the moment he touched the NBA hardwood, but he, you know, basically got spot minutes throughout a career that was much shorter than I thought it would be, because that was really all he could do. Like, if you force him off the line, his handle not good enough to be able to attack a closeout, as you mentioned. And with Hinton, you know, that I think is really the key with the tough shot making is, okay, no, you don't expect him to get, you know, 10 pull-up middies a game, but again, you know, there's a difference between shot clock grenade and ball swings your way. Can you do something with it? Can you make a quick, good decision? And that's sort of the one offensive sticking point that I, you know, want to go into here, which is, you know, does Hinton have the ability to attack a closeout? Yes, that's there. But you mentioned the playmaking, and I'm curious sort of what you've seen so far on that front, because for me, that's really the key element that, you know, he'll need to have is, as you mentioned, you know, that role versatility, right? He'll need to be someone who, okay, he can attack the closeout with the ball in his hands. You know, maybe you don't run him being the primary initiator offensively, but if he's running a secondary action, can you be confident not only that he'll be able to create himself a look out of that, but as you said earlier, you know, where's the sort of line in terms of how much he can create for others? And certainly if you're going to be that kind of 3-and-D player in the modern NBA, again, you know, it's one thing to be able to shoot at an incredibly high level. And obviously that's, you know, one of the two key areas of 3-and-D, right? But if all you can do is shoot, those kinds of players, I feel like, have been pretty systematically drummed out of the NBA in the last 5 years or so, to the point where anybody who's just purely a shooter, there has to be something else. Even if, you know, it's 3-and-D, like, you know, OG Anunoby just got himself a very large contract from being an exceptional 3-and-D player without much of the playmaking element. But, you know, if you're talking about someone who, again, isn't quite the same size and athletic ridiculousness that OG Anunoby is, there has to be, I think, at least a little bit of playmaking. So I'm curious sort of where you think he's at with that now, and where do you think his playmaking might go? Because certainly that's a benefit to him having the ball as much as he does at Harvard, is he'll have plenty of opportunities to make plays for others. The question is just, can he at a high enough level?
For sure, and I'm in absolute agreement with you. And that's really what I want to see, is what does the playmaking look like? Right now, I haven't seen too much to where I'm like, all right, I really do think this is going to be a high-level pick-and-roll player and the playmaker out of that, or just this super connector at this point. A lot of times when he's coming off of pick and rolls, it's like he's wired to score. It's kind of passing is secondary at that point. And it's a lot of head down, may not have seen the guy in the first read. So I think just with more time, I want to see that continue to progress. And I would think just with you getting more comfortable with that role, getting those reps to film, you'll be able to see things happen, be able to read the defense on film and have that translate, especially as you see that more and more on the court. So right now, I'm not that optimistic in projecting. Certainly want to see more, small sample size. Here we go. But I do believe that, as you said, he'll have plenty of opportunity to learn and grow with that. And that's one thing that I'm really excited for him to continue to do. And then he will have those chances to attack closeouts and make a play off of that. So certainly that's something to look forward to as well. And I know you just touched on the defense just a little bit as well. And then OG, the tools, like, to be 6'5". I'm not at this point expecting to be this versatile shutdown type of guy or really a plus defender at this point, to be honest. I mean, I believe he's at 0.7 stocks per game right now. It does some stuff at the point of attack, but I'm not super confident with him defending NBA point guards at this juncture right now. I really don't anticipate myself projecting to do that. I'm open to being proved wrong, of course, as early in the stage, but just at 6'5", not the most explosive and loud athletic tools. There's just some concerns about how versatile he is defensively, how good of a defender he's going to be. Personally, I'm just looking for him to be a capable defender who's active, utilizes length, and you hope that he becomes a defensive playmaker, more of a team type of defender.
Yeah, I love to be wrong when it's in a positive direction. Like, I underestimated someone and they do much better. It's much better than being wrong the other way. But, you know, as you say in the piece, like with most prospects, I'm going to quote you directly here. Like with most prospects, especially freshmen who are the offensive focal point, the defense is a mixed bag. And look, you know, again, it's the kind of thing where there's sort of a very low baseline of do you put in the effort? And that's there, right? And that's a very, very crucial first step, because the guys that don't reach that first step, you know, shout out Jimmer Fredette, tend to be the kinds of players that struggle to, as you mentioned, have that sort of role versatility. But that, I think, is, you know, really the key is, you know, as you say, hopefully his length and effort can help him become a defensive playmaker and or a serviceable defender. I say this all the time. And, you know, again, we're going to do the small sample size thing again, but the statistic that translates the most readily from non-NBA league to NBA league is steals rate, followed pretty closely by block rate. And it's been a long time since I've seen the exact numbers, but it's something like around 90% of the time, if you're a high steals, high stocks player in college, in, you know, EuroLeague, in the NBL, in wherever, you're going to be a high stocks player at the next level. So, you know, even if it's something where, like, okay, you know, Walker Kessler isn't blocking like 5.5 shots a game, but he showed at Auburn that he was a very good shot blocker, and surprise, surprise, he gets the NBA, he's a very good shot blocker, right? It's it's a matter of degree, right? If you're someone who makes plays defensively consistently at the college level, you will continue to do that at the next level. And with Hinton, you know, again, it's like, okay, he has 2 steals and no blocks in 3 games, you know. Could he go out in his next game and have 3 blocks and 3 steals and all of a sudden this looks different? Yeah, that's the problem with the small sample size conversation. But that's the kind of thing where, unless that's something that you expected to translate from a lower level, really the only players that go from like non-steal block guys to steal block guys at the next level are either players who have ridiculous physical transformations or guys who just get to the next level and start gambling, and then that's actually not helpful defensively if you're just getting a ton of steals by only gambling, right? So with Hinton, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the physical tools aren't perfect, but he has a couple of key ones in my mind. You know, he's got at least some, you know, at 6'5", he's not, you know, going to be one of the biggest players on the court ever, right? But he's not someone like Boogie Flan where you're like, oh, this guy's small, this might be a problem. Like, you know, Rob Dillingham, right? It's like this guy, it might be small to the point where it's an issue. With Hinton, I mean, he's got the size, he's got the wiry strength, even though he can stand to add more weight. Again, he's not going to be one of the, you know, he's going to be on the skinnier side, but he's not going to be one of the like super, super skinny guys. I don't know. I mean, you know, there's stuff to like, there's not sort of the eye popping stuff, but you know, who knows, 2 games from now, he could, you know, get 10 steals in his next 2 games and all of this looks stupid, but developmental wise, he needs to be able to defend at least an average level, I would say, because, you know, you're like he's probably going to earn playing time with his offense, but you need to be good enough on both ends if you're this kind of player who's not going to be a, you know, offensively ball dominant kind of star at the NBA level like he's been at Harvard. I don't know. I mean, I'd love to get your opinion, but I feel like there's at least a baseline with his effort and his decent size, but it needs to get to the point where that's clearly at least average and maybe a plus for him to carve out a longer term NBA role anyway.
Yeah, you can have to defend at some decent level, especially if you're there for the offense. We'll see if he become what type of shooter he ultimately does end up becoming. And I remember just they're two different players, different types, but Baylor Shine was a guy that I liked a lot last year. I know a lot of people at No Ceilings did as well too. A nuclear shooter. He was a 6'5", 6'6". Not a great athlete, but he tried. And he was able to rotate defensively, you know, within the team scheme, play help and do those type of things. So for Hinton, if he doesn't kind of develop into a elite or borderline elite shooter, it has to be the playmaking, as we talked about, has to be some sort of ancillary skill. Even I do like the rebound, which I'm interested in. I think he's, what, around 6 rebounds per game. Maybe that is something that certainly can help. I don't think that it's going to be like the compensator or the kind of ancillary skill to kind of push him over. But I am a sucker for guards and wings that can rebound and help out bigs. And when you go small, those are also very helpful. But it will be, it has to be something that really steps up to support that, especially if it's not going to be the defense. But it remains to see what that really does play out to be. I just wish there was just at least a little bit taller, just a little bit more explosive. It'll be much easier to project moving forward.
You might wish he was a little bit taller, but he doesn't have to wish he was a baller. He already is.
He certainly is.
That was awful. Someday I will forgive myself for that, but it's not this day. Before we move on to sort of the final section that I wanted to get into before we wrap up, I want to talk about a prospect who, again, you mentioned earlier that we were going to talk about at the end here, but honestly, I think my biggest concern with Robert Hinton right now is the story of Malik Mack. Malik Mack, who burst onto the scene last year for this exact same Harvard team, averaged 23 points a game in 7 games in November, 51% from the floor, 53% from 3-point, 52% from the floor, 53% from 3-point range, 85% from the free throw line. If you look at Malik Mack's numbers the rest of the year, they were not quite as impressive as that 7 game stretch to start the year. And, you know, it's funny, I ended up writing the Mackenzie McBacco write-up for our No Ceilings preseason draft guide, which if you haven't checked that out, please do so. But for those of you who have, you know, the very interesting thing with McBacco was he had an awful first 5 games for Indiana. And after that, he was really good. And certainly, you know, his strong start to this season makes it seem like, okay, maybe the 28-game sample to close the year is more indicative than the 5-game sample to start the year. But it's really great when you have a, you know, very, very strong 5-game, 7-game sample to start the year. You sort of burst onto radars in a way that, you know, there's sort of the flip side of this, which is Tyrese Proctor's first season with Duke. He had a great last couple months, and there was sort of this, oh, anticipation for what he's going to be next year, but he's not a this year guy. Like, if you close the year strong, people talk about you as the next year guy. If you start the year strong, people talk about you as the this year guy. And with Mack, I mean, again, you know, he still had a very strong season at Harvard, but that shooting percentage fell off a cliff after November. And, you know, again, small sample size alert, but through his first 2 games at Georgetown, he's shooting 22% from 3-point range. And I still believe in Malik Mack. I still buy into Malik Mack, but that does really concern me that with this being the second year in a row that a Harvard freshman guard has gotten off to a scorching hot start that put them onto draft radars, is it something where, you know, once something happens often enough, you start to see, hey, maybe there's a pattern here, and maybe just, you know, Harvard giving the ball to these guys who don't show up on scouting reports because they're just entering college gives them a, you know, runway to have that kind of a strong start. So there are definitely a few things in my mind that differentiate Malik Mack and Robert Hinton in terms of NBA and current projection, but I did just want to bring that up because there are a little bit too many parallels for me to dismiss that notion as just, oh, these are two different guys that happen to both have had strong starts.
Yeah, definitely. And what a backcourt that would have been this year. I'm sure Tommy Amaker would have loved to have them for sure, really at the top of the Ivy League for sure, rivaling the duo of Kaden Pierce and Xavier Lee as well, too. So that certainly would have been something. But yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Malik Mack and those parallels. I think they're both are essentially playing. Mack is more of a point guard than Hinton is, but they're both operating as primary initiators. There are both athletic concerns, you know, physical tools concerns, which I think is the long-term issue with both of them. Hinton with his size being 6'5", I think Mack's 6'2", 6'3".
Yeah,
I think
he's listed at 6'1", actually.
Oh, okay. So I gave him a couple
that gets me, spoiler alert, but that gets me into my big thing is, you know, it's asinine, it's reductive, but the four difference of height does really make a difference when you're talking 6'1 versus 6'5". I would argue a lot more than pretty much any other height distinction, right? 6'5 to 6'9, okay, you're on the wing either way. 6'1 to 6'5 is you go from, you know, okay, maybe average to smallish guard to, is this guy going to be big enough to hold up at the next level?
Exactly. The game completely changes. The projection completely changes on both ends of the floor. And I'm excited to see Mack. I'll see him again on Saturday. I'll be there for the game against Notre Dame. He gets a chance to match up against Marcus Burton, if I'm not mistaken. I hope I got his name right. But 5'11 point guard out of Notre Dame, who was fantastic last year. So that should be a heck of a matchup. But like these matchups for Malik Mack, they aren't going to get any easier. You're getting into the Big East, getting out of the Ivy League. So guys are going to continuously have NBA size, quickness, length, and those type of things. So the numbers are not favorable, aren't ideal to say the least, to start for Malik Mack against competition that quite frankly hasn't been that great. So I'm looking to see if he's going to find that switch and turn it around, and hopefully that soon.
All right. So before we wrap up, I just wanted to touch on the last buzzer beater you have at the very back end of the piece and talk about Adu Thierro, because he is someone who I was intrigued by the flashes he showed his freshman year. I was very much starting to get on board last year, and he's taken, you know, again, small sample size, right? But, you know, in those first two games and, you know, particularly in their most recent game against, you know, one of the highest levels of competition there is in a, you know, national TV game against Baylor, they lost, but Thierro was the best player on the floor. And not only was he the best player on the floor, but, you know, he showed, and again, you know, small sample size, blah, blah, blah. But the fact that he's taken 5 threes in those two games, as opposed to his first 2 years where he was not even at a three-pointer a game, right? Like, he took 9 three-pointers his freshman year at Kentucky. He's already, you know, almost up to half that in two games at Arkansas. But with Thierro, it's basically everything else is why I was intrigued. You know, incredible athlete. You mentioned, you know, his ability to contribute on the boards as a guard, very helpful. You know, we talk about defensive playmaking with Hinton. Well, Thierro is averaging 3 stocks a game through his first two games. And that's something that, you know, if you talk about the per 40 minute numbers last year, he was at 2 blocks a game, you know, 1.5 steals a game. He's someone who really is a high level defensive playmaker. And then the only question that I had really was, okay, but, you know, the flip side of the 3-and-D discussion, right? If you're only a defensive guy, there isn't much of a room for you because teams don't want to play 4-on-5. You have to do something. And, you know, again, there are some guys who just, you know, the Gary Payton the seconds of the world who just do everything other than shoot so well that they find a way. You know, Bruce Brown was really indicative of that. You know, he's been much more consistent of a shooter than Gary Payton the second, certainly. But with someone with Thierro's profile, I think the long range shot really needs to be there. And, you know, again, 2 of 5 is 40% from 3-point range. Congratulations, you hit 2 of 5. But for me, it's the fact that he's already, you know, he's taken 2.5 of them per game in an Arkansas offense that, you know, if he didn't perform as well as he did against Baylor, might not have had as many scoring opportunities, right? For me, it's he's everything else. The shot just needs to be there. And if the shot is there and he's taking them at a volume where he doesn't have to be great, but he at least has to be respected out there. There's certainly been a lot of encouraging signs on that front early in the season.
Yeah, there certainly has been. And as you mentioned, he is a terrific defensive playmaker. I think he's a guy that can defend multiple positions. I think he's going to have a good chance to defend point guards, be disruptive at the point of attack. I think he got all three perimeter positions. I believe he should have a chance to guard more perimeter-oriented fours as well, too. And the confidence that he's shown shooting the ball. And then from what I saw, when I think we talk about someone else in this team who shooting will be important, I thought at times this season, especially in that Baylor game, I thought he looked more confident shooting than DJ Wagner did. And that was something that I did not expect to see, you know? So, yes. I'm excited. Did you see similar things with him and DJ Wagner shooting, or what did you feel about that?
I mean, for me, it was more I'm concerned about DJ than it was this is great for him. But, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I was very willing to buy back into DJ Wagner very quickly this season at Arkansas. I think there was a lot of just, you know, factors that did not mix well for his sake last year on that Kentucky team. And I thought, you know, and again, it's so early, you know, like 2 weeks from now, DJ Wagner could have gone on like 240-point heaters and we'll be like, what were we talking about, right?
But, yeah, can we erase that from the internet? Yeah.
Exactly. Just go back to the archive and scrub that. But no, I mean, I think that's a very good point is, yes, you know, I was admittedly looking at it more from the, this is not what I want to see from DJ Wagner. But the flip side of that, yeah, it's very encouraging for Thierry, even just to take them. I mean, as you mentioned in the piece, like 31 three-pointers total over his first 2 years at Kentucky. Given that he's taking 2.5 a game so far, you know, some quick math, that means he'll reach that 31 threshold in 12 games. So,
yeah,
that's definitely an encouraging sign if the trend line continues of him being willing to buy into his shot, because, you know, a lot of the other stuff was there. I mean, especially last season, you know, his ability to finish inside the arc was really impressive after, you know, again, the sample size is freshman year. He played 190 minutes. He shot the ball 29 times. Like, there's only so much you can dig into there. But with him, you know, being as athletic as he is, his, you know, abilities, he's an exceptional cutter too. You know, all of that sort of combines into an, okay, great, but all of these sort of ancillary skills that you have won't be respected as much as they should be if you can't at least try to shoot. And, you know, will he be a 40% three-point shooter this year? I would be surprised. But he could very easily continue to average 2.5 three-pointers a game attempt-wise. And that, I think, is the more important statistic for me than where the percentage ends up at the end of the year. As long as it's not like, okay, he ends the year shooting 19% from three, that would be awkward. But as long as he's taking them on a decent volume, I think that's more important just because defenses have to at least imagine that you're going to shoot out there. They have to at least respect the concept that you could shoot out there a lot more than just, okay, you're knocking down three-pointers at a high rate, because that's not going to be the calling card. That's not going to be the selling point for Adu Thierry as a draft prospect. It just needs to be respectable. And certainly there is very positive signs in the early going that it will be respectable.
For sure. And one question I do want to ask before we get out of here is, how much do you think the Ryan, I guess I call it the Ryan Dunn effect, will be on him and players like Thierry? He's not quite the defender that, I mean, Ryan Dunn was just otherworldly as a defender, but still someone who is such a versatile defender, defensive playmaker. If someone believes in the shooting and they see the confidence, you have to go back more to Ryan Dunn's high school and AAU tape to see more of that confidence and some of the shot-making skills that he and flash that he did show. But Thierry's showing a little bit of that. So I wonder how much will teams be like, all right, I like this. We see Ryan Dunn. But on the flip side, you know, you can't get burned by that as well, too. And just to plug Nathan real quick, he did a fantastic piece talking about Ryan Dunn's shooting progression, and then also had that accompanied with a terrific interview I'm still trying to get through, but love what I've heard, listened to so far with Phil Beckner as well, talking about shooting. So just wanted to see what you thought about kind of the Ryan Dunn effect on him. And do you think that's something that could work for him positively or negatively moving forward in the cycle?
Wow, that's quite a question. For me, and I actually just recently said this on my other podcast, the Kings Weekly podcast, when we were talking with Gerald Bourget of PHNX Sports about the young season for the Phoenix Suns. And Ryan Dunn is such an anomaly that I compared him to Kawhi Leonard. Like that's that's really sort of where I'm at with it. Of, you know, I've said, and you've never heard this one before, so I can pull out this line on you and you're not sick of it, but I call myself a partial free throw truther of because of the fact that there's a lot more variance in free throw shooting, but also that there's often a much larger sample size of free throw shooting that when you talk about translation to the NBA level, oftentimes the free throw numbers are a better indicator of touch and shooting potential than the 3-point numbers. And this is very mean, but I've called it the Derek Williams principle of you can have one year where you shoot 50% on 73 point attempts and all of a sudden people think you're a shooter and you're very much not. Ryan Dunn shot 53% from the free throw line last year. 53%. He made 7 of his 35 3-pointers after making 5 of 16 of them the year before. It's like, I say that I bring out the Kawhi Leonard comparison because it's a ridiculous comparison to make, but Ryan Dunn is the first player that's come along since Kawhi Leonard where it's been such a clear delineating line of this guy's in college, he cannot shoot. The jumper is a problem. It will take time to fix. And, you know, it's one of those things where there's so many prospects where people just say, oh, if the shooting comes around, oh, if the shooting comes around, oh, if the shooting comes around. It pretty much never does to the degree that it has for Ryan Dunn. And again, it left me so scrambled for answers that I was reaching back to Kawhi Leonard for when is the last time that someone who is this much of a non-shooter becomes a shooter. So when we're trying to, you know, sort of paste the Ryan Dunn comparison onto any new prospect, I have the same wariness that I had for the previous, you know, 12, 13 years of nobody figures it out like this. You know, it's like, it's a once in a decade example of that. The flip side with someone like Fierro is, you know, again, he's 2 for 6 from the free throw line so far this year. That I don't think is a large enough sample size to matter. What I'm much more interested in is the fact that he shot 80% from the free throw line last year. He shot 70% the year before. You know, his first 2 years, he's 76% from the free throw line. Is that, you know, elite of the elite level touch? No, but to me, it shows that, all right, there's something in there. You know, there's a potential to sort of stretch it out to 3-point range. And, you know, the example that I always think of is Brook Lopez of, no, he did not shoot threes before he became the current version of Brook Lopez, right? You know, he was a 20-point a game post-up scorer for the Brooklyn Nets, but the people who didn't watch those Nets teams, and I forgive you completely because God, there were some bleak years in there, bleak, bleak Nets seasons in there. But, you know, Brook Lopez was one of the best 18 to 20 foot jump shooters in the NBA. And basically Milwaukee said, all right, take 2 of your 7-foot steps backwards. Like literally just, all right, 18 to 20, make that 22 to 25, right? And when you see a shooting progression like that, or one of my favorite prospects in recent years to evaluate, Daron Holmes, who I'm very upset will not be playing this season, but with him, it was like his first season, I think he was 1 for 7 from 3-point range, something like that. And then year 2 at Dayton, he's like 31% on like an attempt a game, something like that. And then year 3, all of a sudden, he's shooting 38%. He's taking 3 of them per game, but he's not, you know, doing the Steph Curry, you know, 74 dribbles into a 3-point pull-up, right? He's just, okay, what do I need to do? What is the shooting element that I need to add to my game? I just need to be a good standstill guy, right? As Daron Holmes, you know, my passing is exceptional. I have incredible athletic gifts. All I need to do with the shot is just make sure that when I'm the trail 3, defenses have to guard me. Defenses have to pay attention to me, right? That was a slow, steady progression over the course of his 3-year college career from this guy can't really shoot, but there's touch indicators, to this guy's shooting a little bit, but not the volume that, you know, he really needs to, okay, this guy's a shooter now. I can see each of the developmental steps along the journey that makes me willing to buy into the concept of this guy can be a shooter. With Fierro, I think there are the indicators, if you look at the past 2 seasons, that there's some touch in there. With Ryan Dunn, it was just absolutely out of nowhere. Again, 53% from the free throw line. He's basically shooting that from three-point range.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're shooting like a big. I shouldn't disrespect. I know there's a lot of talented bigs, a lot of bigs with tremendous touch. So there were some bigs that were shooting better than him on more volume. So it's just really incredible.
There are most bigs who are shooting better than him on big volume. it's insane. And it's one of those things where, you know, I've said it about Kawhi Leonard with the shooting. It's been said thousands of times about Draymond Green with any sort of tweener power forward center prospect. You can't bet on any of these guys to be that ridiculous of an outlier. But every once in a while, you know, every 10 years or so, you get the Ryan Dunn, you get the Kawhi Leonard. And I'm not saying that, you know, Ryan Dunn is going to be, you know, finals MVP, all NBA type player, but that's how far back I have to reach to pull of, okay, this guy went from just absolute nothing shooting wise to all of a sudden he's a floor spacing threat in a real way. It's remarkable. And don't try and pin that on future prospects coming up, because it's one of those things that you really only see once a decade. Like that's a reach even to be once a decade, given the, I guess it was like 13, 14 years between Dunn and Kawhi Leonard. It's, again, like I get the sort of, not even desire, that's not the right way of putting it, but like the concept of, oh man, if we could teach this, because Ryan Dunn was a staggeringly gifted defensive prospect to evaluate, but it's like, there are so many guys who, like the Draymond Green tweener types, oh, you know, if only this guy was a better passer, only if, you know, if he had slightly better, you know, defensive help understanding. It's the same deal where it's very easy to find the target of, oh, well, why can't this guy be Ryan Dunn? Because basically nobody can be Ryan Dunn. And there are hundreds for every Ryan Dunn, for every Kawhi Leonard, there are hundreds of guys who've circled, you know, around the sort of bottom end of roster turn at the NBA level of, if only he could shoot, if only he could shoot. Not like those guys aren't trying, right? It's just extraordinarily rare when one of those things works out.
Yeah, those guys are not up there looking to miss, trying to miss, and missing badly, you know? Like, yeah, it's – but credit to Ryan Dunn.
Oh, 100%.
Just the call, the coaches involved with him, whatever he's done to kind of just get his confidence back. Because that's one of the biggest things for me. The confidence just really wasn't there at all for him. Just even – deeper than the non-touch indicators that were there. It's just like he was passing up shots. He seemed afraid to shoot the ball. Then seemed like when he shot it, he had no idea if it was going in or not, you know? And then to be able to come and develop to where he's at and has support of guys like KD and the veterans there. And it was a clip online, I think a few weeks ago, KD was talking about he had him over at his academy during the offseason. He'd be able to learn, kind of develop from there, which is pretty hilarious to hear. And Ryan is talking about, well, you didn't invite me to no academy. But it's just good to see him working with those guys, picking up what he can. It's not like he can touch KD and the shooting will rub off on him, but be able to see how those guys work. And it looks like he's been able to take all of that work on, put into his craft and put it into a major swing skill for him that's certainly swinging the right way for him in Phoenix right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, going full circle with what we were talking about earlier with Hinton, you know, having the confidence of a Rip Hamilton as your cousin mm-hmm. is very helpful. But, you know, there's also just the confidence of Ryan Dunn going from, you know, it's not just the confidence, which I think is a huge part of it, but also sort of the flip side of Hinton. Ryan Dunn, you know, his role was not, you're going to be the, you know, on-ball primary scorer for us, right? It's just, you destroy everything defensively and anything we get from you offensively is a plus. All of a sudden he gets to the next level and it's like, all right, if I'm going to stick at the NBA level for, you know, have the kind of career that I want to have, I'm going to need to get to the point where I don't think about putting it up, right? It's not just, you know, getting to the point of, okay, you know, I've put in, you know, 500 shots a day over the summer, you know, 1,000 shots a day, lock myself in the gym, all those sort of, you know, all those phrases that people use to, you know, like put on 74 pounds of muscle, all those, you know, lovely off-season conversations that you get. But I think you're absolutely right with Dunn. You know, the main point was like, it's not that I need to, you know, it's not like I have a, you know, hideously broken jumper that I need to rebuild from the ground up. It's really just when the ball touches my hands, I need to be willing to shoot it, and I need to be ready to shoot it, and I need to be able to shoot it. And that confidence point is where all of those "if only he could shoot" guys get stuck, right? You know, there's sort of the thing that I always go back to of, you know, they have the practice free throw numbers up in the Lakers gym, and Dwight Howard shoots like 80 yes. something in practice. All of a sudden he gets the game and he's hitting 60%, right? And, you know, it's one of those things where we're talking about, you know, ridiculously elite outlier of outlier athletic, you know, psychopathically competitive people, but just as a human being, right? Imagine the concept of standing at the free throw line. There's 20,000 people in the arena. There's, you know, million people watching on TVs all around the world. They are waiting for you to screw up. And just as a human being, maybe you can't relate to dunking the ball from the free throw line, but you can relate to, oh shit, I'm in the middle of the room and the whole crowd's eyes are on me. Right. And if you can't get past that point from a confidence perspective, then that's where you get these guys who just try and try and try and try and try to learn how to shoot and just can't get to that point that Kawhi Leonard and Ryan Dunn reached almost immediately upon transitioning from college to the NBA.
Yeah. And it's just like you're saying, it's just a different story once the lights really turn on in the game. Like, you can practice and do all you want. You can hit 100 threes a day from each spot, wherever the case is. But, you know, palms get sweaty. You know, things get a little tight when during the games for people, especially when it's like you're wide open. I'm supposed to hit this shot. I'm supposed to take this shot. I've hit it in practice, but I've had not have a lot of success, little to no success in actual games. You know, it can be a really tough situation.
All right. Is there anything else you want to touch on before we wrap this up?
No, that's it, man. It's been incredible. I've certainly really enjoyed this.
It's been a lot of fun. And as I said in the pre-show, we only went 20 minutes longer than I said we would. So that's actually pretty good. All right. He is Jam Hines. You can find his work, of course, on NoCeilingsNBA.com. And you can find him on Twitter at Jam on the Boards. You can find me on Twitter at NBA Johnson. And you can find my written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com as well. If you've been enjoying the show, please subscribe on whatever podcast player you might be using. And if you haven't yet, please also take the time to leave a rating or a review. Always much appreciated on our end. And if you have any feedback regarding the deep dives portion of the podcast, feel free to reach out to me either via Twitter or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.